Sponsor for this week's addendum is The Great Courses. Now, I'm going to assume that most of you listen to this podcast, a podcast run by three lawyers and that has a lot of great legal detail, because you're intrigued by the law and you want to learn as much as possible. And that is the motivation behind The Great Courses. The Great Courses is a really engaging video and audio lecture series that is taught by experts in their field. And one of those courses is the series on privacy, property, and free speech, law and the Constitution in the 21st century, and is a great fit for our listeners because it shows insights into how modern technology is impacting our Constitution and our rights, and it brings to light all the complications that we are experiencing and are going to continue to deal with as we move forward in the tech age. Now, The Great Courses is celebrating their 25th anniversary. They've got over 500 courses. And one of those courses, the one we just mentioned, right now is on sale for up to 80% off the original price. And this is a special limited time offer for undisclosed listeners. So you can get Privacy, Property, and Free Speech along with eight other of their best-selling courses for up to 80% off by going to thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Hi and welcome to the 10th addendum of Undisclosed, the State versus Adnan Syed. This week's addendum is called Ride Along. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow at the New America Foundation, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. And I'm joined with my colleagues Colin Miller and Susan Simpson. Susan is an associate at the Volcker Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also one of the blog editors at the Evidence Prof blog. Now, in last week's episode, we had some tremendous information to share with you, and that was about a previously undisclosed February 1st, 1999, anonymous tip that went into Crime Stoppers. Now that tip, although we couldn't be sure in terms of confirming who the identity was, but we based it heavily on some notes that we found in the police file. These were notes in which Jay took a ride with some police officers, detectives, and the notes seem to indicate that he's interested in a motorcycle and there's some connection to a reward there. After which the police went and they spoke to a teacher at Jay's school who, in fact, had a motorcycle to sell. And of course, as you know, the tip was paid out later that year, but those connections have yet to be confirmed. But those notes were pretty interesting. They didn't just talk about a reward. There's a lot of things going on in those notes that hasn't been talked about before. So in this week's addendum, we're going to discuss those notes. We're going to also discuss a number of Twitter questions that our listeners have. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Colin and Susan to get us started.
It's often said that a person's first statement is the most reliable, but there's also a phenomenon known as context-dependent memory. According to this phenomenon, a person will be able to best remember past events by returning to the places where they occurred. In episode 10, we noted how Detectives Ritz and McGillivary did a ride along with Jay on March 18, 1999, in which they drove to the various locations that Jay supposedly visited on January 13th in an attempt to jog his memory. But did that ride along have its desired effect? Let's start in the ride along notes right after Jay dropped off Adnan at school in the middle of the school day on January 13th. Before that, Jay told the cops during the ride along that on the 13th, Adnan and he had gone to the mall where they saw Jay's aunt in the perfume department at the Hecht. That aunt, of course, was never interviewed by police. Now, Susan, what do you make about the police never interviewing the aunt about whether Jay and Adnan went to the mall on the 13th?
We know they were at least interested in talking to Jay's aunt, Aunt Diane, because she does show up on a to-do list that the cops put together of witnesses they wanted to talk to and people they were interested in hearing from. However, like a lot of names on that list, especially names connected to Jay and Jen, they never followed up on it, or if they did, they didn't save a record. So to me, it's evidence that the cops weren't believing the story that Jay was feeding them. Because if they believed it, they would really want to talk to this aunt and find out that, yes, her nephew did come by one day with a friend, and they shopped at lunchtime and then left. That would basically confirm part of Jay's story anyway, And it's part that Adnan says didn't happen. So to that extent, it could be impeachment evidence for the defendant.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, were the police worried about whether Jay's story would in fact be corroborated? And there's good reason for them to have been worried. We can see after Jay drops off Adnan at the school, he next directs the detectives to take him to the Pusateri residence. According to the ride-along notes, when Jay initially arrived at the Pusateri residence on January 13th, Jen wasn't home. As a result, Jay leaves to go to the Highs store to get a soda. According to the notes, Mark went with him, period, not sure. In other words, it looks like, according to the notes, Jay thinks that Jen's brother Mark accompanies him to the Highs store, but he's not entirely sure. So Jay then directs the detectives to the Highs store during the ride-along. By the way, if you're wondering, Highs store, it isn't a drug shop or something like that. It's actually a convenience store that's in Delmarva, Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia. They're most known for their ice cream. After arriving at the Highs store, Jay directed the detectives to drive him back to the Pusateri residence. The notes then state, quote, Jen's still not home, second trip out for cigs, i.e. cigarettes, not sure. Now, this is the end of Jay's daytime trip to the Pusateri residence. And at least from my perspective, this is basically crazy because at trial, you might recall, Gutierrez's primary tactic is to argue to the jury that it's Jay who may have been the person who killed Heyman Lee. Jen at trial is Jay's alibi. She's also the primary witness to corroborate his testimony. And yet when Jay does his ride along with the detectives about his occurrences and his events on January 13th, at least according to my reading, he never saw Jen on the afternoon of the 13th. Instead, he only saw her brother. And yet again, as far as we can tell, Mark never interviewed by police at any point during the investigation. Now, Susan, I think we were discussing before, you have possibly a bit of a different interpretation of the notes.
Yeah, it's hard to tell how literally we should take these notes. They were shorthand sometimes and apparently written by the cops in the car as they're driving around. So it's possible the fact that Jen is never mentioned, except for not being there, is just a side effect of that. Perhaps Jay did tell them, oh yeah, after 10 or 15 minutes, Jen did show up at the house, and the cops just decided not to write that down in their notes. Still, the absence of Jen at any point in these notes is pretty striking on its own.
Yeah, we know Jen's story is she was home when Jay first arrived. So even if Jay is correct that eventually Jen arrived home, their stories are fundamentally inconsistent. And my reading is there's no mention of Jen. He specifically says twice that Jen wasn't home. That second time he says, I make a second trip out, and the ride-along directions don't show him arriving back at the Pusateri residence. That gives me serious pause in thinking that Jen, according to Jay, was never home. You know, why would Jay lie at this point? Jen has already said she was there. Jay has said she's there. Seems to me like a lie. Whether that lie is about being at the Pusateri residence, period, or about Jen being there, not sure. But yeah, I take this as Jen was never home, according to Jay in the ride-along notes.
I also take these notes, though, to be less a statement from Jay and more an attempt by the cops to repair the damage that Jay's two very different statements have done to the case. I think that a lot of the weird details in here, and there are a lot of them, were designed with a very particular purpose in mind, and that was to fix these inconsistencies and to explain why Jay had said the bizarre things he'd said. So when we have things like Jay going out for cigs and Jay going out to Highs and Jay not being sure if he's with Mark or not, I think that, for instance, is an attempt to reconcile Jay's story with the phone logs, which show during this time period at least two calls to the Pusateri house. So if Jay is with the phone at the Pusateri house, why is he calling the Pusateri house? Answer, well, he's not at the Pusateri house, which means the cops needed to invent stories for why Jay had left the house twice and may have been calling back to the Pusateri residence to see if Jen was there.
And then after Jay directs the cops to drive away from the Pusateri residence, he directs the cops to take a right in the street, followed by a left on an avenue. To the left of these directions in the ride-along notes is a name, and that name is
Neighbor Boy. This is his first appearance in the official record, because at this point, his neighbor Laura has yet to make the police report. So the cops had no reason officially to know his name.
If you follow the directions that Jay gave, the right on the street, the left on an avenue, about 0.6 miles away from the Pusateri residence, is in fact Neighbor Boy's residence.
It's not quite on it, but it's pretty close. He's definitely passing that intersection at the point where the cops write down Neighbor Boy, not his real name, obviously.
And Neighbor Boy, by way of reminding you, he's the one who, according to quote-unquote Neighbor Girl, said that he saw Heyman Lee's body in the trunk of a car. And according to Neighbor Girl, at least during Serial, it was Adnan who had showed Neighbor Boy the body in the trunk. Of course, this never really made any sense because Neighbor Boy was a good friend of Jay. He wasn't a friend at all of Adnan. And of course, we also know that Neighbor Boy has consistently denied seeing anything. And as Susan noted, besides this, Neighbor Boy's name had never come out of Jay's mouth in connection with this investigation. And yet, during the ride-along, it's there. And Susan, what's the importance about Neighbor Boy appearing at this point in the notes?
I have no clue. it's significant that Jay is mentioning him. This name is not coming from the cops. So whatever happened at that moment, for some reason, Jay blurts out Neighbor Boy's name. And the cop is like, well, that's important. Let's write this down. And again, this is a month before Laura makes her report saying that Neighbor Boy told her about seeing a body in a car. So whatever significance the name has for them, it's not that. We also know that months after that, in August, they do interview Neighbor Boy, but again, they save no notes, so we have no idea what they actually talked about. But what we do know is from what Adnan's private investigator found back before trial. And when he talked to Neighbor Boy, Neighbor Boy said that about a month before Hay's body had been found, he'd been hanging out with Jay and two other friends. Now, a month before Hay's body was found puts us right around January 13th, which could mean that Neighbor Boy is mentioned because Jay knew that on that day, he had been with Neighbor Boy and two other friends hanging out and smoking weed.
For me, there's three possibilities. One is that Jay is just blurting out this name despite the fact that he never saw Neighbor Boy on January 13th. Certainly a possibility. The other is Susan just mentioned. Maybe he did see Neighbor Boy, but it's in a completely different context than the claim that Neighbor Girl has made about Neighbor Boy seeing the body. The third is, well, this is a point in time during the day when Jay is alone. He is leaving the Pusateri residence. Adnan's at school. Jay isn't saying he's with Adnan. If there's any validity and veracity to the claim that Neighbor Boy saw a body in the trunk of a car, the only mention in any narrative by Jay or Adnan of Neighbor Boy is when Jay is alone, and that tells you. I personally don't think that Neighbor Boy saw anything in the trunk, but if he did, Jay's only narrative with Neighbor Boy is when he's alone and not with Adnan.
But again, this goes back to what I said about the cops using this interview to try and push their own narrative onto Jay's story. I don't think this is necessarily coming from Jay because, for example, the fact that Jay had to leave Jen's house before receiving the come and get me call appears to be an artifact of the cops' mistaken records. When they were taking their notes, putting their files together, the cops wrote down that the 2:36 p.m. call had been made on L651C. That's the same tower that the supposed Best Buy calls were made on. And it's not a tower that, by their math, would have covered Jen's house. So, and again, the 2:36 call was on L651B, which does cover, according to the cops, Jen's house. So it actually kind of fits out. It works. It should have worked by their logic. The problem was their records were bad. And in order to make the come and get me call match the cell phone records as they'd mistakenly written them down, they had to have Jay leave Jen's and head west before that call comes in.
After these notations, Jay tells the detectives to take a right, followed by another right, followed by a left, and the notes indicate Jeff G., not at home, turned around. This is similar to the story that Jay tells at trial, and the directions on the ride-along notes, in fact, do take you to Jeff G.'s house, which was another 0.6 miles away from Neighbor Boy's house. You might recall, though, that this was not the initial story that Jay gave. In his pre-interview, the very first thing we have on the record from Jay, he said he went to the Pusateri residence, the only mark was home, at least at first. He recounted a trip to the high store. He talked about getting a call from Adnan about leaving school, and he talked about Jeff G. But in the pre-interview, Jay's story is that Jeff G, in fact, drove him to Woodlawn to see Stephanie in the parking lot at 3. So it's kind of interesting that, at least in certain senses, Jay's context-dependent memory seems to actually match his first recorded memory up until the point, at least, where he now says that Jeff G is not at home. Instead, again, the claim now is that when Jeff G isn't home, he gets the Best Buy call from Adnan, and that, of course, sets into motion the events that form the heart of the prosecution's case at trial.
Of course, that call was 5 seconds long and therefore was not an actual conversation between two people, but the cops aren't going to let a little thing like that stop them. You know most of the rest of the story from the Route Talk episode of Serial. Jay meets Anon at the Best Buy. There's a trunk pop. They go to the I-70 park and ride. They go to Forest Park and weep. They go to the cliffs of Patapsco State Park. And then Anon goes back to track to establish an alibi. So after leaving Patapsco State Park, Anon has Jay drop him off at school. In that episode, Sarah chose to use Jay's trial testimony, in which he claimed that Anon either made or received a call as they were entering the school parking lot, resulting in a conversation in Arabic. Jay said that he believed it was Anon's mother calling him. As Sarah noted, this is odd because neither Anon nor anyone in his family actually speak Arabic.
The ride-along notes, though, seem a bit more definitive. They state, quote, telephone call, mother, incoming, as they entered school lot. Now, if we look at Adnan's call log, after an incoming call at 3:15 p.m., the next incoming call is 4:27 p.m., and it pings the L654C tower. So if you believe Jay, this seemingly has to be the quote-unquote mom call. And again, if you believe him, it undermines, once again, the proposition that incoming calls are reliable for determining location, because Woodlawn High School falls well outside the expected coverage range of L654C. Of course, as we've said before, based upon the AT&T cover sheet, incoming calls are unreliable. But even granting that, there's another huge problem with Jay's statements during the ride-along notes. According to Jay, if this call is correct, 4:27 p.m., that means Adnan is almost half an hour late to track practice if it started at 4 o'clock p.m. and almost an hour late if it started at 3:30 p.m. So if we're looking at what's going on here and thinking about it logically, why in the world, if Adnan is trying to create an alibi, is he taking a phone call from his mom as opposed to hightailing it to track practice to make sure that he's not later than he already is? Instead, according to Jay, they're in the parking lot, Adnan's late, he's trying to create an alibi, and instead he answers a phone call from his mom, talks a good 3 minutes. Now he's more than half an hour or an hour late for practice, depending upon the start time. I mean, Susan, does that make any sense to you that Adnan in this scenario would be taking this phone call when he's trying to create an alibi?
Even the alibi story doesn't make sense, so it's hard to, sorry, it's just so hard to take this seriously sometimes. It's hard to like give an actual rational response to it. I mean, no, it doesn't, because the whole alibi story itself makes no sense. If you are on a high school sports team and you're trying to make an alibi about being a practice, you are either going to be there or not be there at all. Because showing up half an hour to an hour late to practice is one way to be guaranteed that you'll be noticed, that you weren't there when it started. I mean, the coach could conceivably not notice if a student's not there. It might just, you know, slip his mind. But I feel like it's a universal trait among high school sports coaches that players showing up super late will be remembered and will be taken care of.
If you're late, you're running laps, there's a punishment, there's consequences. It's far better to just not show up at all and hope that no one remembers that particular day, as opposed to other days when you were at practice, as opposed to showing up more than half an hour or an hour late. After dropping off on track practice, Jay, according to the ride-along notes, leaves Woodlawn. So this would be about 4:30 after the 3-minute phone call at 4:27. He tells the detectives to drive him to Kathy and Jeff's place, which is about 9 minutes away from Woodlawn High School. According to Jay, he smokes a blunt with Kathy and Jeff and is at their place for about 20 minutes before getting a call from Adnan to pick him up from track practice. Presumably, looking at Adnan's call log, this would be the 4:58 p.m. call. It again pings tower L654C. Kathy and Jeff's place is even farther away from the expected coverage range of L654C than Woodlawn High School. So again, take it for what it's worth. And taking it for what it's worth, we still have some serious issues. First and foremost, according to Kathy, she doesn't get home on January 13th until 5 o'clock or so. And while I'm saying 4:27 is the only call that makes sense for the mom call before Jay goes to Kathy's place, in the ride-along notes, Jay himself says, "I didn't arrive at Kathy and Jeff's place until between 5:20 and 5:30 p.m. For going according to Jay's timeline, that would make the 4:58 call the mom call. Adnan's arriving at track practice after 5 o'clock p.m. For this timeline, it makes sense. The 5:38 call to Krista pretty much has to be a butt dial. It's the 6:07 p.m. call that's the track call. I mean, Susan, this kind of seems too ludicrous even to consider that Jay is dropping off Adnan after 5 and not arriving at Kathy and Jeff's until 5:20 or 5:30, right?
Jay literally needs a TARDIS to make even a portion of this work. It's an impossible story. It's why they describe it in Serial as plotting the coordinates of someone's dream, because things bounce around in time. Events do not happen in chronological order. Cause and effect does not seem to apply. And logical explanations for why people are doing things are in very short supply.
Giving the benefit of the doubt, Adnan is dropped off about 4:30. He gets the call to be picked up from track practice at 4:58. Well, that leads me to two conclusions, again, assuming that this is correct. Well, one, you have to believe in this case that track started at 3:30 and not 4, because if track started at 4 o'clock p.m., how in the world is it over before 5 o'clock p.m., allowing Adnan to make the 4:58 call? And then second, and this goes back to your point, Susan, before about creating a good alibi, under this scenario, basically, Adnan is showing up for track practice a little bit after 4:30. Practice is over by 4:58. He's basically only there for the last 20, 25 minutes of track practice. That's just insane if you're trying to create an alibi to show up for the basically tail end of track practice, right?
Well, if you want to convict Adnan, you don't have a choice but to believe the story. So, I mean, might as well believe it, right?
I'm really trying to figure out how any of this can make sense, and it really can't. And when you build into that, Susan, what you have sort of pieced together looking at Coach Tsai's notes, you know, Coach Tsai has this recollection about Adnan having a conversation with him about leading prayers at the mosque. And in fact, this conversation makes an appearance in the ride-along notes, right? So after we have Jay returning from Kathy and Jeff's place, what do the notes tell us?
There's a side note written to the left of the directions where one of the cops has jotted down a comment that Jay apparently made of them as they're driving along. And according to Jay, Adnan later made a comment to Jay that, "I'm glad I talked with Coach because he was questioned about it by police," which apparently seems to be a reference to the fact that, according to Jay, Adnan tells him, "I'm really glad I made the coaches notice me that day because the cops asked the coaches about it." And the cops apparently learned that he was there at practice.
Yeah, and Susan, we know, based upon your review of the police interview notes, that Coach Tsai indeed did recall a conversation with Adnan about leading prayers at the mosque. And based upon the weather, the only day that could have been was January 13th. So at first blush, you look at the notes and say, oh, wow, this seems kind of incriminatory because Jay is making it look like Adnan had constructed this alibi and Jay is calling him out on it and telling the detectives, no, this is a fabrication, but we have some serious problems with this theory, right?
Well, at this point, Coach Tsai has not talked to the cops yet. So whatever is going on in this conversation that the cops are writing down in their little notebooks, it's not about Coach Tsai.
Yeah, Coach Tsai isn't interviewed until March 23rd, which is 5 days after the ride-along. He did previously talk to Adnan's private investigator. That's on March 3rd, but obviously that's after Adnan's arrested and after he's done talking to Jay. I mean, I don't know, Susan, is the thinking here that possibly the detectives rewrote these notes after the 23rd to account for Coach Tsai saying he remembered talking to Adnan? I mean, how on March 18th is Jay referencing a conversation that couldn't have occurred until 23rd because Tsai, at least as far as we know, Tsai was not talked to by the cops until March 23rd.
Well, it looks like someone has been talking to Adnan's defense team or has overheard things they've said. That's the only explanation I can come up with, because we do know that even though Coach Tsai and the cops have not talked yet, We know that Adnan told his attorneys that he'd had a conversation with Coach Tsai on January 13th. But the cops shouldn't have known that. Not at this point, anyway.
I don't know what to make of it, but there's serious issues, regardless of what theory you apply to why this note is in the ride-along notes.
To me, it kind of points at this whole weird relationship between the cops and Woodlawn, and how they have their special assistant, Hope Schaub, who is interviewing students on their behalf and talking to teachers on their behalf and collecting information on their behalf. She would be in a perfect opportunity to hear what students are saying, to hear what Adnan's private investigator was talking to other teachers about, and she would probably be the person who would know the most about what Adnan's alibi would have been, because she's the one who's talking to the teachers that the private investigator is talking to. So, yeah, I mean, we don't know what's happening here, but it wouldn't surprise me if one of the teachers was funneling this info to the cops.
Yeah, and this notation about talking to the coach is on the left of the page. On the right of the page is a notation that Sarah brought up on Serial. Adnan said goodbye to track buddy Will, pulled up in front of Jim, may have walked out together, track bag with him. So you might wonder, why am I discussing this again? You might also recall from Serial that Will indicated that no one from the state or the defense had ever contacted him. Now, from the state side, again, this is sort of another baffling oversight. If you're really trying to corroborate Jay's story and determine whether Adnan is legitimately innocent or guilty, it seems Will would be one of the first people you want to talk to. Going to the defense side, I mean, Susan, this seems to me like just yet another glaring omission by Gutierrez, because how in the world does she not have someone from her team talk to Will? He's Adnan's track buddy. He's walking from track to the parking lot. Certainly not beyond the stretch of imagination that he arrived at track practice with Adnan, maybe walked over, maybe saw him in the locker room. It's sort of a no-risk situation. They talked to Will. If he's not helpful, fine. But he very easily could have dismantled the state's case and established a huge part of Adnan's alibi.
Well, and somewhat in her defense, she did not get this document until at least trial one and possibly even trial two.
Now, we do know one thing, and that is Adnan, at least Gutierrez on his behalf, submitted an alibi notice to the court on October 4th, 1999. It was a list of names, and in fact, the state, in its latest brief to the Court of Special Appeals, said all the names in this list shows the depth of the investigation done by the defense, and it tends to rebut the claim of ineffective assistance. Well, if we look at the alibi notice, one of the names in the list is Will, the track teammate. According to Will, he was never contacted. And so what that tells me is this document is pretty much worthless legally. It's a list of names who possibly could have been alibi witnesses, but it tells us nothing about whether Gutierrez actually contacted these witnesses or not.
I mean, I guess the only significance that I can make out of this whole part of the interview notes is that the cops knew for a fact Adnan was a track. They had no doubt about that. Their only concern was making sure that did not interfere with their case. So one way or another, they had to account for the fact that Adnan was there, and they do it by inventing this, he was an hour late, was there 20 minutes, and then left story. But it's all they had to work with, so.
Speaking of what they had to work with, that takes us to the end portion of the notes. This is what we discussed in episode 10, the Crime Stoppers episode. We have the notation we mentioned about Mr. Brown selling his motorcycle with 9,000 miles. A few pages later, we had the last pages of notes. And on that very last page, Susan, you noticed something.
Oh, can we back up a bit, though? Sorry.
Yeah.
It's a great document because there's a lot of interesting wrinkles to Jay's crazy stories all over the place. My favorite is probably on the same page as the track notes, where Jay apparently tells the cops that he and Adnan had a conversation about where to bury the body. And apparently, Adnan suggests DC as one of the options. I mean, I hope this never happened. I cannot imagine the two of them driving around in Baltimore, and you know where we should bury a body? Washington, D.C. Let's go there. Makes total sense.
Yeah, and this last page in Detective Ritz's handwriting, it has Stephanie, Jay's girlfriend's address, followed by the notation, private investigator going to discredit, followed by reward in all caps. To the left of these notes are the words Billah, spelled B-I-L-L-A-H, and Organize, spelled O-R-G-A-N-I-Z. Now, this has, of course, fueled our speculation that this is referring to the Crime Stoppers reward. As for the private investigator, well, Stephanie's house is mentioned. Is this referring to the trip that Jay and Phil took to try to interrupt Stephanie's interview with the PI? Is Bilal, the mosque member who would later testify before the grand jury proceedings, that he had seen Adnan at the mosque on the night of January 13th and gone over the prayers that Adnan would lead the next night? What we do know is that Bilal was, in fact, interviewed the very day before the ride-along on March 17th, so it would make some sense that his name is in the notes. Overall, though, we don't know. We can only ask the questions. Hopefully, they can be answered at some point. What we do know, once again, though, is the story that Jay tells during the ride-along is markedly different from the story he would eventually tell at Trials 1 and 2. What we also know is, between this ride-along and trial, Jay gave one more statement to the detectives. It was on April 13th, the same day Adnan was indicted, the same day the lead detective on the case would have been able to fill out a checklist to determine the helpfulness of the tipster and whether he was entitled to a full or only a partial payout. We have the transcriptions of Jay's interviews on February 28th and the 15th of March. We have notes from his pre-interview and his ride-along. What we lack, the one thing we lack, are the notes from his March 13th interview. What was said during that interview by Jay, what was said during the cops, does this missing link explain how we get from the story on March 18th, the story at trial, to yet another mystery in a trial, a case that has no shortage of them?
Well, Jay testified that the April 13th interview involved the cops questioning him about inconsistencies in his story. So we know at least that much was going on in the interview, which by itself should have made it Brady material, but they got away with never producing it.
We've laid bare all these inconsistencies on March 18th, and all of a sudden a trial, a lot of them have been ironed out, whether successfully or not. It's so essential to know what leads Jay to change this story, what they're telling him, what they're asking him, what he says. And yeah, we just have this big missing link where we don't know what happened.
It's almost as if Jay's willingness to tell so many stories and tell so many lies is an unintuitive form of armor for his testimony. He's told so much ridiculous stuff that him saying a few more ridiculous things doesn't matter. Any other case, any other witness, you had even a tiny fraction of these problems in his testimony, and he'd be destroyed. He'd be discredited. You would never put him on the stand. And yet somehow, Jay tells so many lies that he then changes to different lies so many times. No one seems to care. It's all right if Jay lies. It's all right if Jay never tells the truth, because no one expects him to. And we can all just assume that the one thing he's not lying about is Adnan being guilty. One last note that I think is pretty interesting and worth mentioning about the 318 ride-along notes is the contents of pages 19 and 21. Now, these notes come from handwriting on pages of a spiral-bound notebook. There's no numbers on them, so we don't really have an order of pages to go on, other than the order that they are produced in by the prosecution. But what concerns me is that pages 19 and 21 contain the same exact material rewritten. There's a couple things different about them. Some of the details are not the same, but both of them involve Jay telling a story of when he walked out into Lincoln Park and saw the coat on the ground, the coat that previously had belonged to Hay, but after Hay's coat was found in her car, suddenly became some strange coat they didn't recognize. And Jay describes how he and Adnan have a conversation basically about whose coat is that? I don't know. And Adnan tosses it into the woods. But this would not happen twice. There's no reason that the cops would write down this exact same scenario two times, unless Jay got it wrong the first time and they wanted to correct it. Which to me suggests that, I mean, we cannot trust that these notes are in fact a verbatim of what the cops wrote down on March 18th. Because either they were, I mean, I can't explain why else they would have written the same story down twice in a row, unless they were trying to repair an initial version of events that didn't quite work out. The first page of these notes, Jay describes how he throws a cigarette next to the log where his body was found. In the second version of the notes, Jay is throwing a cigarette by the roadside on Franklintown Road. So I think the cops were concerned that they hadn't found a cigarette back there close to Hay's body, and they needed to explain why Jay's cigarette wasn't at the crime scene like he said it would be found. But again, if the cigarette was thrown by the road, much easier to explain how it got lost, got kicked away, and wouldn't be found by investigators.
Yeah, in big picture, we're discussing here how the detectives realized some holes and inconsistencies in Jay's story, and they're possibly fixing them during the ride-along. Well, fast forward to April 13th, Jay gives his final statement to detectives after grand jury testimony is given. Not hard to imagine, once they hear all that testimony, figuring out further issues and in some way helping Jay to iron out that story that eventually becomes the trial story.
So the first question we have is from Jane Harder, whose Twitter handle is @JaneAHarder. She writes, "What will it mean for Anand's case if it turns out that the tipster was not Jay?" It depends on what the actual factual scenario is here. But first, it's possible that the tipster might not have been Jay, and Jay still could have been rewarded, as the interview notes and other evidence seems to indicate. So we actually have two questions here. The first is, who was the tipster on February 1st? And the second is, where did that money go? Where did the $3,075 go when it was paid out in November? So it's possible that Jay didn't make the tip and did collect money, but you may recall it hearing mentioned, either on Serial or Undisclosed, that at some point, Jay asked the cops to stop recording because this line of questioning doesn't make sense to him. Well, that happens when the cops start asking Jay, why didn't you make an anonymous call? Why didn't you phone something in anonymously from a payphone and tell us that way? And Jay's response is to ask them to turn the tape off. For whatever reason, that question freaks him out. But if it wasn't Jay who made the original tip, whether or not that tip was Brady depends on who it was and what it said. So Colin, what would happen there? What are the possibilities if it's not Jay?
Yeah, there's a few possibilities. The first thing I'll note is that even if Jay didn't get the reward, if it can be established that he was trying to get the reward, which is certainly implied by the ride-along notes, the interview of Coach Brown at the school, the blue book value of the motorcycle, that Supreme Court case I mentioned, Collins versus Whitley, could easily be read for the proposition that Jay tailoring his story to try to get the reward, even if he didn't get it, is Brady. If it's any witness for the prosecution, that's almost certainly a Brady violation. If it's someone who is never called as a witness, as Susan said, that's going to depend on a few variables we laid out on episode 10. Some of the theories about the blinders put on and the focus on Adnan could lead to a Brady violation. We would really, though, need to look at tipster's identity and content before saying anything definitive about whether, in fact, it's a Brady violation. But certainly, any tip by any person, there would be an argument there, and you just would need sort of more evidence to say something definitive. This question comes from tweets by Beth. Her Twitter handle is @GreatBlakes. She asks, if Adnan is released, does he have grounds to sue for wrongful conviction, even if he takes the Alford plea? Again, an Alford plea is the constructive equivalent of a guilty plea. A person isn't actually admitting guilt, but they're admitting the state had enough evidence to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. By taking an Alford plea, which is what happened in the West Memphis 3 case, that forecloses the option of bringing a wrongful conviction claim. If we're right about a Brady violation, if we're right that Jay's testimony was tainted, I no longer think that Alford plea is something that Adnan would take. I don't think the state could re-prosecute, and that would lead open the opportunity for him to possibly bring some type of claim against the state of Maryland. I've mentioned before, Maryland has sort of restrictive laws about recovering, but there's certainly a possibility if there's these Brady violations that he could recover against the state based upon a wrongful prosecution.
Kleep Yang, whose Twitter handle is @shortessay, writes, in Tony Williams' case, how could he go to trial over and over again? Doesn't that violate double jeopardy? Well, no, because the double jeopardy clause applies when a defendant has been tried on charges and a final judgment has been reached. That's why when there's a mistrial, there's no double jeopardy violation for a retrial to occur. In terms of what happens when a case has been appealed, if a conviction is overturned, then typically you will not have a double jeopardy violation because that previous judgment has been vacated. There's no final judgment on the record, and everything is cleared for a second trial to occur. The one exception to that would be when you have cases that were overturned due to insufficiency of the evidence, which means that when the appeals court looks at a case and says, well, yes, you did get a conviction, but that conviction can't stand because there actually wasn't any evidence to support it. In that case, the judgment is final, and if there's a reversal on those grounds, retrial cannot occur. That wouldn't be an issue here. So if the appeals court did reverse a non-conviction, the state would be free to try and recharge him and have a third trial. However, like Colin said, that's not going to happen. I don't see at this point any realistic possibility that the state of Maryland will retry Adnan Syed.
It's interesting. I cited DeCalles versus Whitley before. That's the case again where the man Beeney had gotten the Crime Stoppers reward. In that case, there was some stronger evidence because there were eyewitnesses. But of course, Beeney and what he said was impeached based upon him angling for and getting the reward. The state in that case actually did try to re-prosecute the defendant a couple of times, and both times it was a hung jury and no conviction. In Adnan's case, if Jay is tainted, that's it. I mean, there's no way they could prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, especially with the AT&T cover sheet, the lividity evidence, the evidence of Asia as an alibi witness, the fact that there was no wrestling match, meaning that Inez's testimony is worthless, the athletic director's statements. I mean, it's just, at this point, there's no reasonable way in which the state would try to take this before a jury again. This question comes from Molly Kelly Elliott. Her Twitter handle is @mkemu. She asks, why use pings instead of Brady to reopen the case? The answer to that is simple in that Justin Brown, having just filed this supplement, it's based upon concrete evidence we have. The AT&T cover sheet that says incoming calls are not reliable to determine location. As we mentioned in episode 10, while we have the inklings of a Brady violation, the state has not been responsive to MPIA requests. They're not disclosing information about the Crime Stoppers tip unless and until we have the concrete information on tipster identity and content. We don't have a full-blown Brady violation that we can claim yet. Question is, how prompt will the state now be in responding? Once that information is in, absolutely it can be used, but until we have that information, it's too preliminary to make any legal filing based upon the speculation.
And our last question comes from @EllieJorge, who writes, will we be hearing more about Tayyab in the upcoming episode? He's a piece of the puzzle I can't let go of. So Tayyab was a couple years older than Anand. He went to the same mosque as Anand's family. He was also friends with Jay. And there's been a lot of speculation that he might have been, well, what was then thought to be the February 12th anonymous caller. There's no hard evidence that he was. I haven't seen anything beyond rumor that he was the one who did, but it's possible. The only reason Tayyab's even in the case record, though, is because of what Jay says about him. Here's what he said during his first interview.
Other than you being with Adnan that night, do you know of any other persons that Adnan has confided in to, or bragged to that killed Haley?
No, but I'd imagine it must be somebody else. Maybe Tayyab. I think he might have said something. I don't think he killed Tayyab that he killed Hay. I think he told Tayyab that he killed someone.
Tayyab?
Tayyab.
How would you spell that?
T-Y-A-B.
And who is Tayyab?
He's a friend of his.
Do you know Tayyab's last name?
Hussein.
Do you know where Tayyab lives?
No.
Do you know his phone number?
No.
How old is Tayyab?
He's either 19 or 18.
And how do you know, or why do you think, that Adnan has told Tayeb what happened?
That's how Tayeb is.
But has Tayeb ever mentioned to you that Adnan has told him what happened?
No.
I'm just trying to get an idea.
You have to understand Tayeb, like, for a lack of better choice of words, he's into that type of stuff. You know what I mean? It's not.
Into what?
Murderous, killing, you know, don't care. I mean, talks about how it was wonderful in Pakistan, stuff like that. I mean,
Tayeb is also from Pakistan and the Muslim.
Yeah.
So Jay imagines that Anand might have told Tayeb that he'd killed someone, but doesn't think that Anand actually would have specified who he'd killed. In the second interview, the story changes again, and suddenly Jay says he was in the car with Anand when he overheard Anand have a phone call with someone, probably Tayeb, and that Adnan was talking about how he'd killed someone.
Is there anybody that you know of that Adnan told about this murder?
100%? No, I don't.
Okay. What percent, possibly?
I'd have to say that I knew he told somebody that he killed somebody. I don't necessarily know that he told somebody that he killed Hay, but I know he told somebody that he killed somebody. It was on a phone conversation later in the car. I don't know who he's talking to. I can speculate. I think it was Tayeb.
When was this?
Probably like 4 days after.
After?
After he killed her.
Okay. And why were you in the car with him?
I was out in the car with him. I was leaving from my house, going to work.
He was taking you to work?
Yeah.
This is probably where the rumor comes from, that Tayeb was the anonymous caller. I mean, Jay does tell the cops twice that Anand kinda confessed to Tayeb. However, everything Jay says about Tayeb doesn't check out. For one, I've spoken to Tayeb's family and friends, and all of them laughed when I told them about Jay's statement to the cops about Tayeb being into murders and killing, whatever that means. Jay was making that up. There's nothing about Tayeb that would actually justify that kind of comment. And besides, we know that Jay's whole description is made up because of what he says about Tayeb talking about how it was wonderful in Pakistan. Tayeb is Indian, not Pakistani, and he would never have been telling Jay about what it was like in Pakistan because he's not from there. I mean, it's just more proof that Jay will lie about literally anything. He doesn't need a good reason to do so. He just wants to make a story more colorful. Even if we assume that the anonymous caller was Tayeb, it doesn't change the state's Brady problem here. Because where did Tayeb get his knowledge of the case from? Jay. At some point, sometime before August 1999, Tayeb told Anand's brother that he'd talked to Jay about the incident. Tayeb had asked Jay, and Jay said that he had helped Anand bury the body. Jay told Tayeb that Anand had called Jay the day before asking for his help in the murder. Jay said his reply to Anand was that he would not help in the killing, but he would help Anand bury the body. Jay further went on to tell Tayeb that he met Anand on the day of the incident at a gas station where Anand showed Jay the body. So if Tayeb was the caller, then again, this is Brady evidence because it impeaches Jay's testimony. First, we've got the fact that Jay is making up yet another story about the trunk pop. This is number 7 on the list. And second, we've got Jay telling the cops twice that Anand confessed to an unspecified murder to Tayeb, when Tayeb says his knowledge of this thing comes from Jay, not Anand.
While we can hazard the best educated guesses based on what we know, the truth is that the only way to confirm who the anonymous caller was is for Adnan's attorney, Justin Brown, to subpoena the evidence. But it doesn't mean that the state won't fight it. They can fight it, and then we have to see how a judge rules. As far as I'm concerned, all evidence is good evidence, and this is such a vital piece of what really happened and how it happened that not getting to the bottom of it would mean that the injustice of this not being disclosed 16 years ago would remain. So, here's to hoping that that doesn't happen. Now, a quick heads up for tomorrow on Tuesday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Susan, Colin, and I are going to be joining Seema Iyer on her MSNBC show, The Docket. And this show streams online. You can find the link to it by following Seema on Twitter. And we'll also send the links around beforehand. You can also search for The Docket, and you're easily going to be able to find it online. We're going to be discussing new materials and evidence that we found recently, thanks to Seema and her intrepid producer. And we hope you can join us. So earlier we noted that the notes from Jay's April 13th interview with Detectives Ritz and McGillivray were never produced, despite the fact that these were the missing link between the vastly different stories that Jay gave during his ride-along and then at trial. That April 13th interview was also the last time that Jay officially gave a statement to the police. But it looks like the police weren't the only folks Jay was having discussions with. This case could not have gone the way it did without someone bringing it all together. Enter Prosecutor Kevin Urich and his deal with Jay. Next time on Undisclosed. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @UndisclosedPod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.